Let's get down to business. Taking a look at Wall Street, Dow Jones Industrial Average down 36 at 22,048. S&P 500 down a fraction of a point at 2,474. NASDAQ down 18 at 6,352. Russell 2000 down 13 at 1396. Yield on the 10-year Treasury down 4 basis points at 2.24%. Oil up 52 cents at $49.69 per barrel. Gold up $16.20 at $12.77.90 an ounce. Fire and fury, and frankly, power the likes of which this world has never seen. Not a phrase that resonates well on Wall Street. Following Trump's remarks, North Korea said it was carefully examining plans for a missile attack on the U.S. Pacific territory of Guam, home to a large U.S. military base. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis told Pyongyang it should stop any actions that would lead to the end of its regime and the destruction of its people. Well, investors scurried to safe haven assets today. At this point, the threats are just rhetoric, so there was no freakout. Global markets switched to risk-off mode, with gold bonds and the yen all rising, but world markets didn't seem to be particularly bothered or worried about war breaking out on the Korean Peninsula anytime soon. Historically, financial markets haven't exhibited any extraordinary volatility in response to provocations from North Korea. North Korea says crazy stuff, and the country has a very long history of not delivering on its threats. South Korea's KOSPI index fell 1.1%, its currency, the won, down 0.9% against the dollar. The South Korean stock market has year-to-date roughly tripled the performance of the U.S. market. It's up more than 30%, and that outperformance comes despite the geopolitical risk posed by North Korea. Actual war or military action would be cause for alarm, but right now, thankfully, it's just saber-rattling. Secretary of State Tillerson says that Americans should sleep well at night, at least until 3 a.m. when the next tweet drops. We'll see what tomorrow brings. A handful of defense contractors trended higher with the saber-rattling. Shares of Raytheon, L3 Technologies, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, and General Dynamics all up more than 1%. Retailer Office Depot down 26% after posting a quarterly profit that missed expectations. The FBI searched a home belonging to Paul Manafort, as President Trump's former campaign chairman, part of the federal probe into Russian meddling in the 2016 election. The raid took place at Manafort's residence in Alexandria, Virginia, July 26th. Investigators collected some material during the search that they then took away with them. FBI agents are working with a team of prosecutors led by Special Counsel Robert Mueller. The Trump campaign last week turned over about 20,000 pages of documents to the Senate Judiciary Committee, which is conducting its own Russia probe. Manafort provided about 400 pages on August 2nd, including his foreign advocacy filing. Productivity grew more than expected in the second quarter as hours worked rose at their fastest pace in 1.5 years, leading to a modest increase in labor cost. The trend in productivity, however, remains weak, suggesting robust economic growth will be hard to achieve. Labor Department said non-farm productivity, which measures hourly output per worker, rose at a 0.9% annualized rate in the April to June period. First quarter productivity was revised to show it edging up at a 0.1% pace instead of being unchanged as previously reported. With productivity rising, unit labor cost, the price of labor per single unit of output, increased at only a 0.6% pace in the second quarter after jumping at a 5.4% rate in the January-March period. Productivity increased at an average annual rate of 1.2% from 2007 to 2016, well below its long-term rate of 2.1% from 1947 to 2016, indicating the economy's potential growth rate has declined. To get back to 3% real GDP growth with the demographics the U.S. is facing, productivity growth will have to exceed its long-run average growth of 2.1%, so don't hold your breath. U.S. credit card processing company Vantiv secured a deal to buy British-based Worldpay for $10.4 billion. Although Vantiv's deal was first announced July 5th, it's taken a few weeks to conclude, with the deadline for a formal offer extended twice. Goldman Sachs is acknowledging that it's getting harder for institutional investors to ignore the Bitcoin market, which has ballooned to about $120 billion. The debate has shifted from its legitimacy to how fast new entrants are raising funds. Do a lot of investors use digital currencies like Bitcoin? Are those digital currencies a big part of investors' portfolios? Are those digital currencies a threat in any way to financial institutions or a potential ally? Well, to find out, Fidelity Labs, the R&D arm of Boston-based Fidelity Investments, is starting a test to let its customers see their digital currency holdings on Fidelity.com, like any other security in their portfolio's summary view. Fidelity is partnering with Coinbase, a digital wallet and asset exchange platform. Customers can give Coinbase permission to share data about their holdings in Coinbase wallet accounts with Fidelity. Customers can then view their Bitcoin, Ethereum, and Litecoin balances like any other information in their Fidelity accounts. Bitcoin is a digital currency. It operates through its own blockchain. The shared, reportedly tamper-resistant, record-keeping technology that can also be used to verify other transactions. Fidelity has a stake in the emerging technology. The organization has venture investments in organizations performing blockchain research, including TradeBlock and Axani. And while the blockchain technology behind Bitcoin might have value, the actual Bitcoins have no inherent value, just what the market is willing to pay. What could go wrong? Well, today marks the 10th anniversary of the financial crisis. August 9th, 2007, BNP Paribas froze three of its investment funds, barring investors from withdrawing billions of euros because of a lack of liquidity in the U.S. markets. At the time, the French bank was the third largest in the world by assets. BNP had invested in mortgage-backed securities, and 10 years ago today, they could not figure out valuations. And when that happens, it means the investments are worthless. For a bank that size to admit that it simply had no idea what some of its U.S. property assets were worth rattled the markets. Many now consider this the unofficial start of the global financial crisis, which led to millions of job losses and trillions of dollars spent to bail out banks around the world. At the time, banks really didn't know what was hitting them. There were earlier warning signs. In June of 2007, Bear Stearns, the venerable Wall Street bank, had to stop customers withdrawing money from two of its investment funds. The funds had specialized in the financial products that had been created on the back of those subprime mortgages. These products were, in theory, designed to spread risk. Individual loans were packaged into new types of securities called collateralized debt obligations, or CDOs. These packages contained a mix of loans. The plan was that because it was highly unlikely that all the loans would fail, they were safer But Wall Street built a financial pyramid on top of them, creating new derivative trades that piled risk and leverage on top of the basic lending. When a few of the loans started to go wrong, the panic spread. Bear Stearns found, suddenly, that it could not find a buyer for any of its investment funds. At that moment, they were worthless. The crisis, of course, peaked with the demise of Lehman Brothers, another Wall Street bank that, like Bear Stearns, had piled aggressively into various derivatives that bet on other derivatives with no inherent value. Credit became unavailable throughout the economy. A full-blown systemic banking crisis was at hand, the root of which was a lack of trust. Banks would not lend to each other. Knowing all too well the dodgy assets on their own books, they feared they would not be repaid. Countrywide Financial and numerous other lenders could no longer obtain financing starting in 2007. Housing values came racing down. Stock prices followed their precipitous descent. One of the most remarkable commentaries in retrospect about the crisis came from Bear Stearns' chief economist David Malpass, writing for the Wall Street Journal August 7, 2007, days before the BNP fund freeze. He wrote an op-ed with the headline, "Don't Panic About the Credit Market." Malpass wrote, "Housing and debt markets are not that big a part of the U.S. economy or of job creation. It's more likely the economy is sturdy and will grow solidly in coming months, perhaps years." Well, last week, Malpass was confirmed by the U.S. Senate to serve as Undersecretary for International Affairs at the Treasury Department. 10 years ago, the four biggest banks in the world, Royal Bank of Scotland, Deutsche Bank, BNP, and UBS. Today, the four biggest banks in the world, all in China. Royal Bank of Scotland, Deutsche Bank, the first and second ranked global banks by assets at the end of 2007, they're still paying the price for their involvement in the selling of dodgy U.S. mortgages and many other misdeeds. RBS, bailed out by the U.K. government, still majority owned by British taxpayers. They expect to make it a full 10 years before it returns to making annual profits, now the 24th largest bank in the world. Deutsche Bank's share price down 80% over the past decade. The U.S. government pumped money into the banking system to recapitalize shaky lenders during the depth of the crisis, and strict new regulations to make the system safer were introduced in Europe. If U.S. banks were too big to fail back then, they're even more so now. Dow Jones Industrial Average today down 36 to finish at 22,048. S&P 500 down a fraction at 2,474. NASDAQ Composite down 18 at 6,352. As always, we invite you to follow along at moneyradio.com, live streaming and archived audio. The daily blog, eatthebankers.com.